This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Good evening and welcome to the Birch Aquarium. My name is Nigella Hilgarth and I'm the executive director here. It's really a pleasure to welcome you to the latest Jeffrey B. Graham Perspectives on Ocean Science lecture. And tonight it gives me great pleasure to introduce our wonderful speaker, who is Martin Tregeres. And he got his diploma at the University of Buenos Aires in Argentina, and his PhD in Canada at the University of Alberta. And then he did his postdoctoral work at Weill Medical College at Cornell from 2007 to 2010. And then in November of 2010, he came here to Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego, and he is an assistant professor at Scripps. And his research interests are really on the physiology of aquatic organisms. And he conducts research on a wide range of organisms, and his interests include the evolutionary relationships between the basic cellular functions and the complex whole animal physiology. And he is a part of the leadership of Scripps Institution of Oceanography's work on ocean acidification. And he really shows how marine organisms sense and adjust to acid-base disturbances which arise from environmental and metabolic variations in carbon dioxide, protons, and bicarbonate ions. And so it gives me very great pleasure to ask Martin to come and talk to us about ocean acidification. Can corals cope? So please join me in welcoming him.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you very much for coming to my lecture. And going to be talking about ocean acidifications and potential responses of corals. But before we get into that topic, I want to take a few moments to remember Jeffrey B. Graham, who gives the names to this lecture. And he was a wonderful, great scientist, wonderful mentor and friend. And in December, is going to be, it's incredible, but it's one year since he's gone. And he's greatly missed by many of us. So now, let me tell you a little bit about myself. I was born in the town of Rio Gallegos in southern Argentina. If you guys are watching at home, hi. And then I did my PhD, my master's at the University of Buenos Aires. And there I studied some physiological mechanisms of certain crabs, how they adjust to changes in salinity and pH. During the summers, I would take research internships in Ushuaia, which is the most southern city in the world. And there I studied ecology of crustaceans and also marine mammals, how they strand in different areas. And I worked at a museum exhibit building up skeletons together. That wasn't very fun. And then in the summer of 2000, I took a course at the Bermuda Biological Station for research on coral reef ecology. And at that time, I just became completely fascinated about the corals. And decided that if possible, I would like to do research on corals someday. However, I couldn't just start working on corals right away. Before that, I took a PhD at the University of Alberta in Edmonton in Canada, a place with wonderful people, lots of friends, but not many corals. So my research was actually on how sharks sense and regulate the pH in their blood. In 2007, I moved to New York City, where I joined a biomedical research lab. And there I studied how cells in general can sense changes in pH at the molecular level. And After that, in 2010, I was fortunate enough to land an assistant professor position here at Scripps. I've been here for almost exactly 2 years now. And in my lab, we study how marine organisms sense and compensate for pH stress. We have projects with diatoms, which are these marine phytoplankton, oysters, sharks, and also, of course, corals. And with corals, what we want to see is how corals sense pH, changes in pH, how corals work in the first place, and then see how ocean acidification may affect those mechanisms. So what is ocean acidification? We have to start by talking about carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and just as many of you know, burning fossil fuels produces huge amounts of carbon dioxide that get accumulate in the atmosphere. Some of the pioneer research in the topic was actually done here at Scripps by Charles Keeling, and he had actually in an observatory in Hawaii where he started measuring levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in the 1950s. And that program still is ongoing. And what we know from those studies is that in around 1950, CO2 in the atmosphere was around 300 parts per million. And now, this was from 2007, it was 390. And now in 2012, they're close to 400 parts per million. So obviously, levels of CO2 in the atmosphere are increasing. Now, to put that into more of a geological perspective, in this graph, again, you have CO2 in the atmosphere, and this is current time, and this is 400,000 years ago. And you can see that even though levels of CO2 change, the changes are not as large as what we're seeing these days, but also that they're not nearly close as abrupt as they're right now. This is since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, they have already probably increased by 30%. By the time we are done burning all the fossil fuels, levels will probably go to at least 1,600 parts per million. That is maybe fivefold more than before the Industrial Revolution. And this is a conservative approach. And by then, we would have finished burning all the fossil fuels, and it would take a few thousand years to come back to normal. And what we know from the building of CO2 in the atmosphere leads to the greenhouse effect that can increase the temperature and lead to changes in weather. We've seen a few of those recently. But also, as I'll show in the next slide, it can affect the seawater chemistry. And in particular, it has been acidifying our oceans. And the reason is that CO2 in the atmosphere is in equilibrium with the ocean, and we have CO2 dissolving into the ocean, and under certain circumstances, the ocean also releasing CO2 into the atmosphere. But now that CO2 has been constantly increasing, what we have is a net increase in the rate of CO2 influx into the ocean. Now, in the atmosphere, CO2 is a gas, but when it dissolves into water, part of that CO2 combines with water and it forms bicarbonate ions and also hydrogen ions or protons. And this is a form of acid, so the more protons that we have in the ocean, the more acidic it becomes. Now, the way scientists measure acidity is through the pH scale. So I'm going to go through a few numbers. I promise this is the last slide with lots of numbers. And if you make it through this slide, you don't fall asleep, the rest will be more enjoyable. But just pH, you're probably familiar with pH because you've heard like the pH of the skin has to be at a neutral pH in order to be optimum, and pH of your stomach or pH of many other areas in the body. And what pH actually is a measure of the concentration of hydrogen ions. But it's not just a direct measure. In reality, it involves a negative symbol here and a logarithm. The reason for that is that hydrogen ions are very tiny little molecules, and you find a lot of them in a liter of water. And for example, at pH 8, that involves 6 gazillion molecules of protons per liter. So as you can imagine, it's not very convenient to say we have this much molecules and then we change to 12 gazillion molecules and to do calculations, those sort of things. It's not very nice. So what scientists have done is they relate this number of molecules to a unit that is called a nanomole. So this number of molecules corresponds to 10 nanomoles per liter. Now 10 nanomoles is 0.000000010 moles per liter. And You can also write it as 1 times 10 to the minus 8 molar. And that is just because you have basically 8 decimal places after the period. Now, when you do the pH, when you apply the logarithm to this number and you put the negative value before, that gives you a pH of 8, which is that number there. So that's where pH comes from. And something that is a little bit counterintuitive is that because of this logarithmic nature and the negative number, the fewer protons that we have, the higher the pH. So, and the lower the pH, the higher the number of protons. What that means is that when pH is low, the acidity of the solution is higher. Another important thing from this, and this one, if you are going to remember one thing from this slide, please let this be this one, is that a change in pH, pH is not linear. So for example, at 8.3, that means that there are 5 nanomoles of hydrogen ions. But then if you reduce pH to 8, it's not a change in 0.3 units like it would be with a kilogram or with a meter or with a foot. It's actually, that's a doubling in the amount of hydrogen ions, so you actually have twice the acidity. If you go from 8.3 to 7.7, it's fourfold higher, so from 5 to 20. And if it is pH 7.6, it's fivefold compared to there. So slight changes in pH are actually large changes in acidity. Now, with that in mind, this is an animation made by NOAA, and what this animation show, if it works, is the average pH in the surface of the ocean since 1880. See how the bluer the colors is, higher pHs. Yellow and reds are more acidic pHs. You see how, for the rest of the century, most of the seawater pH is predicted to go down. In certain areas, it's supposed to go lower than other areas. That's related to the way ocean currents work and many other different processes. But by the end of the century, in certain regions of the ocean, pH is predicted to be as low as maybe 7.7 or 7.6. Now, remember, the nature of the pH scale is logarithmic. What that means is that a change from 8.2 to 7.8 is maybe a threefold increase in acidity. And that is the big question, is how marine organisms might react for that. Because remember, this is 100 years seems like a lot for us, but in evolutionary terms, it's a blink of an eye. So can animals adjust to that, or how are they going to respond? That's the big question. And probably the first concern about the potential effects of ocean acidification was a potential effect on marine calcifiers, such as corals, oysters, calcifying phytoplankton. And the reason for that, or one of the reasons for that, is that, again, CO2 going into the atmosphere, production of acid, and carbonate, calcium carbonate, which is one of the main building blocks of shells, the solubility of calcium carbonate increases with increased acidity. So there is the concern that during ocean acidification, corals and other calcifiers might have, either the shells might dissolve, or at least they might have more trouble, they have to spend more energy to secrete the shell. Just to use an analogy, imagine if you have a shower head, and in your shower head you have a buildup of this like white thing that's actually carbonate. So how do you clean that? To clean that, one of the house remedies is just to dip that in vinegar, which is an acid. The vinegar dissolves the calcium carbonate, and now you have nice water pressure and you cleaned up the calcium carbonate. Ocean acidification is kind of similar to that. It's not as acidic as vinegar, of course, but it's a good correlation. So to picture how calcium carbonate solubility increases, also it dissolves with acid. However, there's a second concern about pH, and is that hydrogen ions or protons are highly reactive. And this is an excellent phrase from Henry Mencken, it's a famous writer from the beginning of the century, of the 20th century. And he wrote several sentences about pretty much everything. And one of them was pH. And so what he says about pH is, life is a struggle, not against sin, not against the money power, not against malicious animal magnetism, but against hydrogen ions. Why did our friend Henry say that? Well, there are many reasons, but the easiest to see is that proteins are built of amino acids. And amino acids, they give a shape to the protein, and proteins are what make the work in a cell. They can help you move a muscle, they can help you see, they can help you. Pretty much all the biological functions are carried out by proteins. Now, when you change the concentration of hydrogen ions or you change pH, the electrostatic interactions between the amino acid is changed, and then so the protein changes the shape. And imagine if you change the shape of anything, they cannot function the same way. So under extreme pHs, there is a risk that most proteins won't be able to work properly, and that, of course, can lead to problems. And we have many examples from human health, human physiology. We've been studying this for centuries now. And just to give you an idea, we know that in humans, a slight drop in blood pH as low as 0.1 pH unit, to remember, it may be a 30 or 40% increase in hydrogen ions, can affect the way we produce energy, can affect sperm and egg function, development, also the structure of bone, many other things, pretty much everything, but those are good examples. And if you and I have sustained acidosis for a few days or even like over longer periods of time, that can lead to metabolic disturbances. Infertility, because the sperm cannot move their flagellum, and the egg, after being fertilized, might not divide properly. Arteries and veins might not be able to contract or dilate in the proper way. Kidney disease, it can lead or be associated with certain types of cancer, diabetes, mental retardation, tooth decay, osteoporosis, and pretty much everything you can imagine, depending on the magnitude of the pH stress. So, given all the potential effects of pH stress, it's not surprising that all living organisms have the ability to regulate their pH in their cells and in their bodies. We are constantly producing carbon dioxide in our cells. That's just the way we work. We burn food, carbohydrates, proteins, and fats. We use oxygen to burn them in mitochondria. That's how we produce our energy. But the end product of this metabolism is carbon dioxide. So this is pretty much the same that happens with when you burn fossil fuels. Now, imagine this carbon dioxide inside of a cell can lead to all these potential problems. So what cells do is, one, they get rid of CO2 by diffusion, but also here the same hydration with water may happen, production of hydrogen ions, and then the cells have very specific mechanisms to extrude the excess protons or acid, to keep the intracellular medium stable. And every cell in the planet has to have the ability to do that. If not, they die. Now, with large animals such as ourselves, we also have, for example, kidneys. And kidneys, they regulate pH of the blood. So if pH goes too acidic, we pee more acid into the urine. We make a more acidic urine. And in that way, we get rid of the excess acid. We also have lungs, so when CO2 is too high, we can just hyperventilate and blow off the excess carbon dioxide. And fish, for example, they have gills, which act similar to kidneys. When blood pH goes too low, so too acidic, they get rid of the excess acid. Now, we know much, much less about invertebrates such as corals, and we don't really know much about how they regulate their pH. So one of the things we're doing in my lab is not only looking at potential effects of ocean acidification, but first you need to know how an animal works, so how do they regulate pH, and then see if ocean acidification might affect them, or if it might be too much and corals might be able to cope or not. So finally, a few pictures of pretty corals. Most of them by Katie in my lab, she's a postdoc, and some of them by Jen Smith and Stuart Sandin, also faculty at Scripps. Well, we all are familiar with this. Magnificent ecosystems. They have, they support a huge diversity of fish and invertebrates. They also support large fisheries, tourism, so it's hundreds of millions of dollars a year that are dependent on healthy coral reefs. But what maybe many people don't realize is these big chunks of reef, is most of that is dead material. It's just a piece of rock, and the live part of the coral is only a thin layer on top of the reef that is actually secreting the rock. And again, to understand how things go wrong, first you have to understand how they work. So let's take a deeper look into how a coral works. If we take a little zoom in that part of the surface of a coral, what you will see is that it's covered by these tiny little polyps that look like they're tiny little sea anemones, which are interconnected to each other. And in reality, here in this diagram, maybe you might be able to see it a little bit better. Here you have one polyp, another polyp, and they're all connected through this cenosarc. So in reality, this that you see like a big chunk of rock is just a tiny, thin layer of maybe one or two human hairs in thickness that are secreting the skeleton, and they're all connected to each other. In a different view, we know that in most parts, the coral is actually four layers of cells. One layer of cell in contact with seawater, it can secrete mucus. It has these nematocysts, which are actually like tiny little harpoons that let them capture prey for food. Then the bottom layer is a layer called the calicoblastic epithelium, and it's the layer that actually secretes the skeleton. So it secretes the calcium carbonate underneath. And then there are a couple of other cell layers. Some of these cells, we have no idea what they do, but then this cell layer, it's very interesting because they host symbiotic algae called zooxanthellae. And the zooxanthellae, they do is they capture energy from the sun, and by photosynthesis they produce carbon compounds that they give to the host as food. And in exchange they get nitrogen compounds, and that's how this symbiosis allow corals to thrive in nutrient-poor waters in the tropics. So now to the recap of how ocean acidification can affect corals, we have at least three different things. Something that is very important is that we have corals that secrete the skeleton, but also we have dead coral that is just a stone. It doesn't have any live tissue on top, but it's also very important because it keeps the whole reef together. It's also substrate for other animals to settle there, and because it's not covered by any tissue, they're in direct contact with seawater, and ocean acidification means a potential contact with corrosive waters. The carbon dioxide getting in, production of bicarbonate and acid, and then calcium carbonate might get dissolved because calcium carbonate solubility increases at acidic pHs. This part of the skeleton, you might think, well, maybe it's not a problem because it's covered by the epithelium. However, one thing that we know is that corals, like us, like every animal, they are producing carbon dioxide, and this carbon dioxide they're getting rid of that by diffusion, and also they're spending some energy to get rid of the excess acid to the seawater. Now, if CO2 outside goes up because of ocean acidification, there's going to be a buildup of carbon dioxide inside of the coral, and that might lead to an intracellular acidification that could affect proteins inside of the coral cells, and it might lead to the dissolution of the skeleton, either dissolution of the skeleton or corals might have to spend more energy to secrete the skeleton. And like everything in life, if you spend more energy on something, you cannot spend the same energy on something else, which for corals might mean reduced growth, reduced calcification, or impaired reproduction, for example. So how do we go about studying the effects of ocean acidification on corals? Well, for that, I want to use an analogy with how do you want to treat or study a disease in humans. For example, cancer or diabetes. There are many approaches that you can use. You can identify which are factors that might lead to these diseases. You can identify a genetic component. And you can also study how cancer or diabetic cells work. In the case of cancer, why cells grow out of control, the molecular basis for this, why they produce metastasis and how they can survive harsh conditions in the tumors like hypoxia, acidity. In the case of diabetes, there's no way you can study diabetes if people hadn't known that how insulin works. That was just basic research studying insulin that led to studies on diabetes, how cells can sense sugar, and etc. But the important point here is that only after you have all this information, you may be able to try to change the cultural factors, to regulate factors that might lead to the diseases, such as food factories, production of plastics, etc. You might be able to design and implement early screens to identify risk, predict how aggressive a tumor may be, also design drugs to treat diabetes or cancer, and also very importantly to educate the public on how to prevent or try to at least reduce the chance of getting these things. So for coral and ocean acidification, that's the approach that I think we have to follow, and we're doing that, I think, pretty efficiently here at Scripps. These are just some examples of things that we have going on. I'm studying the molecular and cellular physiology of corals, certain aspects at least. My collaborator, Dimitri Dehen, he studies biofluorescence and how to identify stress biomarkers in corals. Other labs such as Andrew Dixon and Andreas Anderson, they study seawater chemistry. So they go into the ocean and they try to measure this ocean acidification, how fast it's going, how it's changing other things, carbonate, and other ions in seawater. Other young researcher, Todd March, is actually developing instruments to be able to measure that in different parts of the ocean. Jen Smith and Stuart Sandin, they study coral reef ecology, so how community structure may change, how fish populations may be affected. And David Klein is trying to develop these systems, amazing systems, to try to manipulate CO2 in the reef to study ocean acidification under normal conditions of light and nutrients. So it would be a really excellent model to complement lab studies in the lab with studies in the field. In addition, I want to say that even though it's not related to corals, all of us, and plus other people such as Lisa Levin and many others I'm probably forgetting, were also studying the effects of ocean acidification on local California species. So let me tell you a little bit about my research. We just recently got a grant from the National Science Foundation to study ocean acidification, how coral sense changes in CO2, and some of the physiology. This grant, we only started doing work this in August, so we still don't have many results, but I'll show you some of the things we're planning to do. The project is together with Dimitri Dehen, and it also Katie Barrett is a postdoc who had his own postdoctoral fellowship, and combined is about $1 million for 4 years. The project also involves two PhD students, Megan and Lauren, who are studying signaling of CO2 and maybe oxidative stress and metabolism. Two master students, Jason and Jenny. And also, even though it's not directly related to corals, we have Jinae and Lara, who study similar things in sharks. In addition to that, we have developed collaborations with the Weill Cornell Medical College, the Scientific Center in Monaco, and Rutgers University, and they're going to help us test some of our findings in their systems. They're very well, each of them are experts in their field. The Weill Cornell Medical College will help us develop drugs in order to test and investigate coral physiology. The Monaco Scientific Center in Monaco are probably the leader in coral reef physiology for decades, and they're going to help us investigate the effect of what we find on calcification. And the same as Paul Falkowski at Rutgers, who they have developed these cell cultures that will be very helpful to, again, test our findings in their systems. But by getting all these different experts, that means that we don't have to develop every single thing. We just do our thing, we study intracellular pH regulation and cell signaling, and then the other experts, they can use that in many other different experiments. So one of the things that we have been doing is, in order to study cell biology, is very useful to be able to develop cell cultures. Just imagine to work with corals. Corals are beautiful and everything, but they're a pain to work with to study physiology, because you have a chunk of rock, and then you have 4 layers of cells. Some of them are algae. Some of them, you don't know what they do. So to manipulate that and understand what they do, it's good to kind of deconstruct the system and study all the components in isolation. And after we have that information, try to see how they work together. This is a picture taken in a microscope, so each of these cells is very tiny, 10 microns, so 1/100th of a millimeter. I don't know how much that is in inches, sorry. But here you can already see that there are different cell types. If we look at this with fluorescence microscopy, we can see that some of these cells are red, and that is due to the chlorophyll in the symbiotic algae. And a picture like the shot of the same thing but with the green fluorescence, we see that other cells, they glow in green. And if we put all of that together, this is a merged image of everything, we see the cells and telli, which are actually inside cells from the host. We see cells that express this green fluorescence, but we also see other cells that they vary in size and shape, and there are many different cell types. And by having them in isolation is that we can maybe identify what each of these cell types do. We have been able to keep these cells in culture. So remember, we're taking, dispersing these cells from the coral and having them in a petri dish. And here we show day one, day three, but we kept them for up to 2 weeks. And what this allows us to do is to manipulate CO2 conditions outside in a very precise manner. And we can see how if different cell types respond in a different way. For example, if their pH inside of a cell changes differentially in one cell type over the other one. Another thing we can do is we can use a machine called a flow cytometer. And the flow cytometer detects cells with, for example, red fluorescence, and it puts them in a little tube. Cells with green fluorescence, and you put them in a different tube. And you can also tell the machine to grab large cells and put them in a third tube. And in that way, you can obtain pure cell populations, and then you can use proteomic or transcriptomic analysis to see if they express different proteins. For example, and this is just hypothetical, but let's say this cell type might express cells that transport calcium or carbonate, and that is an indication that they might be secreting the skeleton. So then you can study specifically those cells. You can use these cells to see how the salt antelae respond to the algae respond to ocean acidification, and so on. I mentioned a few times that we measure intracellular pH, and that is maybe more complicated than you might think. To do that, what we use is these pH-sensitive dyes that they get inside of cells. Now, this is not from coral cells. We have not done this in corals yet, but we have done it in oyster cells. These cells are from there are cells present in the blood of oysters, and we can take them from the oyster, put them in a petri dish, load them with the dyes, and these dyes, they have the characteristic that their color changes depending on the pH inside of the cell. And actually, this is just a trial that we did to show that the dye works. What we'll see is that at a certain point, the color changes to a darker blue color, and we know that represents a change in pH inside of the cell of about 0.3 or 0.4 pH units. This is just, we're testing the system just to show you that how the dye changes in color. But what we're planning to do is do similar experiments in corals and change carbon dioxide outside to see, number one, how much intracellular pH changes, and number two, if the cells can compensate for that change and how long it takes them. One of our collaborators is Dimitri, and Dimitri is an expert in biofluorescence, and he has been studying corals for a long time now. And it was interesting because when I first joined Scripps, I was placed in an office right next to him. I was just like talking and drinking coffee and talking about life. And we said, well, maybe one day we should collaborate. I do the pH, I do fluorescence. Let's maybe at one point write a grant and try to work together. Well, I moved to a different floor. And a few months later, we said, yeah, do you still want to do something together? I said, yeah. So we wrote this grant and we got it. So now we're stuck together. But this, for me, is great because he knows about corals way more than I do. And what some of the things he has been doing, he's been trying to use the endogenous fluorescence of the corals as a marker of stress. He hasn't been doing anything with ocean acidification yet, but he worked with temperature and metals and oxygen stress. And he recently produced this just amazing movie showing that here is just a regular camera. Here is a camera that detects fluorescence. Normally, the corals are doing their thing, and then he introduces a cold shock of about 9 degrees Celsius. And maybe here you cannot see it, but he also has a way of quantifying fluorescence, and what he found is that he can detect slight changes in fluorescence that are not visible to the naked eye. After that, he put the coral in normal temperature, and he increase the temperature by about 5 degrees, which is known to cause bleaching, and it's known to be very bad for corals. And here maybe it's more evident how fluorescence, first, it gets dimmer, something that you cannot really see with your naked eye. And then eventually, some of the fluorescence becomes more concentrated in the tips of the corals, but it's fading away from the rest of the coral, and that is something that he can quantify. And after a few days of pH stress, just the coral dies, everything bleaches, and here you see pretty spectacular how all the tissues goes away. But some of the very interesting things about this is that he is able to detect changes in fluorescence a few days before you can see it with your naked eye, suggesting that you, in the future, we may be able to go underwater, measure that in the reef, and correlate fluorescence with how healthy the reef is. And again, he found similar results with metals, oxygen, and temperature. And part of the ground, what we want to see is if we can see something similar with ocean acidification. And even though we only have preliminary results, I can say that it's possible that that might happen. Just the caveat here is that this is just a short-term, four-day exposure, just to show that we can measure fluorescence and detect some changes. We see that the controls, they have fluorescence. It's kind of dispersed throughout the tips of the polyps. You can also see the red dots, which are the cells and telli. But after just 4 days in pH 7.8 as opposed to 8, we see, number one, the fluorescence gets concentrated in the tips of the polyps, and also you see these yellow things, which is mucus that the corals are secreting, probably due to, as a way of it's an indication of stress. So what we're going to be doing is longer-term studies, trying to see what happens after 1 month, after 2 months. Maybe they get, after a few days, they come back to normal. Maybe they don't. But it might be possible to use this in the field to detect stress in corals due to ocean acidification. At least that's the hope. Now, the third component of the grant is something we're very, very excited about, and it's a collaboration here with Birch. And what we're going to do is, of that $1 million for the 4 years, about $100,000 is going to be dedicated to create, first, to do public lectures and TV and online dissemination, such as this lecture that we have right now. But also, in 2013 to 15, we're going to be building, designing and building a museum exhibit to explain ocean acidification and the effect on corals to the general public. Also, we're going to broadcast all the research being done at Scripps. This is going to be located right like north here, where the big coral tank is in that area, just across, like in front of that, in that wall. It's going to be a flat screen, touch screen with different models to try to really put everything and explain it simply to the public. And we're hoping to be able to launch this exhibit in 2015 and 16. Well, there's a little advertisement here. We're looking for some money to try to launch it earlier. So my students will go with a hat after the lecture, trying to collect some money. Yeah, I like in church. So that's pretty much some of the things that we're doing through this grant. Again, we started in August, so we don't have many more results to show. Just lots of ideas, lots of people to work on them. Hopefully next year, we can give you more an update. I want to leave you by, also I want to show you some other research that other people are doing here at Scripps. One of them is Andreas Anderson, and he joined Scripps about a year or a year and a half ago. He is a marine chemist, and he has this really wonderful program in Bermuda. It's called Beacon, and what they're using Bermuda. The nice thing about Bermuda is that the reefs is, because of the current of the Gulf of Mexico, they have reefs, even though they're pretty high, they're pretty north. What that also means is that they're probably going to face ocean acidification conditions earlier than corals in the Pacific or in the Caribbean. So that's why Andreas called them maybe the canary in the coal mine. It's a way of seeing things a few years in advance. Coincidentally, if you remember, this is where I took my summer course down in 2000, which kind of inspired me to go and work with corals one day. Some of the research, very, very briefly, what Andreas is trying to determine is the rates of calcium carbonate production by calcification by corals, algae, and other calcifying organisms versus the rate of dissolution, which might happen due to bioerosion, so stuff that chews on reefs, breakdown by waves and storms, and also calcium carbonate dissolution, for example, due to ocean acidification. And the idea is, even though measuring this is very complex, the idea is very simple. If the net calcium carbonate production rate is higher than the dissolution, then the corals will be fine. If it is the same, it might still be fine. But if dissolution is faster than creation, then Houston will have a problem. And the way he does that is he has several stations in Bermuda in which he takes water samples to analyze CO2, pH, alkalinity, and he measures that continuously throughout the year. And with that, he's able to do spatial data. Here you see it's at large, it's like several, maybe 80 kilometers or so around, and also temporal data, how chemistry in the seawater changes along throughout the year. He has CO2 buoys. He also has, they go and actually takes water samples with a boat. And they complement that with experiments in situ and ex situ. And again, the whole idea is to compare bioerosion versus production of reefs. Another professor here who's doing really interesting research is Jan Smith. She studies, well, among many other things, coral reef ecology in the Line Islands in the Pacific. And these islands are great because they have very little human settlements there, so it's a good model to study the effects of ocean acidification without confounding factors of tourism or pollution. It's just maybe ocean acidification and temperature. And some of the things they have been doing is, again, looking at different parameters of water chemistry in the different islands, and also they can do surveys trying to identify different species in the different sites. And one of the things they found is that, well, number one, they found that pH is not constant. pH actually changes, fluctuates throughout the day due to photosynthesis and respiration. And another thing they found is that in sites with a high mean pH, they have corals and other calcifying algae, but in sites with low pH or low mean pH, they have different type of algae, fleshy algae, and not as many corals. What this suggests is that in the future, if we shift from higher pH to lower pH, there might be a shift in the community composition and might be associated with maybe at least reduced coral reef coverage, with all the implications that has with to fish and other invertebrates and so on. Now, the last guy I want to talk about is Davy, who's sitting here in the audience. And what Davy has done during his postdoc at the University of Queensland in Australia, he designed this just fantastic system to be able to manipulate carbon dioxide on the reef. So before that, or most people, what we're doing is we do it in the lab, and that is a perfectly valid approach, but it has some limitations, like you don't have natural sunlight, you don't have natural nutrients. So what this does, this provides a way, number one, you have acidification in situ with all the other variables are intact. And number two, what he designed is, so this is the chambers that I showed you before. He has a bunch of sensors and controlling systems, and it doesn't just control pH, it doesn't just lower pH of the water. What it does it as an offset from normal pH. So if pH outside is, let's say, 8, then here one of the treatments would be 7.8. But let's say the next day pH in the water is 7.9, then in the chamber it would be 7.7. And that, in the lab, what people now are trying to do that, but by doing that and in the field, it's just, it compensates for natural variability under natural conditions of light and nutrients, and that might give us a more realistic idea of the responses of coral reefs to ocean acidification. One of the things he has been working on is trying to develop these portable systems to take to Panama or the Caribbean or wherever and have just chambers with different treatments, and it might be able also to combine ocean acidification with temperature or oxygen stress. Then this is only the first part of the project. The other part is to see the physiological responses, and that's when I will tag along and try to collaborate on that together. So the original question is, if can corals cope? We don't have an answer yet. Corals are not happy with ocean acidification. We need to determine how corals work, their physiology, how it works in the first place. Also, some species of corals might react differentially compared to others, and that's something we have to know. We also have to study community development, dissolution rates, and production rates. We have to be able to monitor ocean pH in different locations, in different times. And also, very importantly, we have to consider what happens when you combine different sources of stress. Because I hope I convince you that most animals can compensate for pH, but that requires energy, which is fine. We have energy and we use it for that. Now, what happens when on top of that we have stress due to temperature? Well, Now we have to use energy to compensate for that, and it adds up. Well, now we have pollution, or maybe now we have more energy, and at the end, if we combine many different sources of stress, there might not be energy left for other things, such as growth or calcification or reproduction. The key thing here is first to see how each of these things affect coral physiology, and then what happens when you combine them. And after we know the mechanisms, that might be helpful information to try to establish policies to prevent it or to mitigate the potential effects of ocean acidification. So I wanted to leave you here. This is my lab. Thank you to Dimitri, NSF, the Birch Aquarium. This is my email address if you want it. Also, I can give you a card if you're interested. Thanks to all the students and postdocs in the lab. And I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have. Yeah, the question is if ocean acidification, well, he's saying ocean acidification affects other calcifying phytoplankton, of that species. And there are several calcifying phytoplankton species. Some of them are coccolithophores. There are these weird algae. Foraminifers is another one that also they produce a lot of calcium carbonate. And then there are also these tiny animals called theropods, which are actually mollusks, which their shell is also made of calcium carbonate. I don't want to go too specific here, but different animals, even though calcium carbonate is part of all of these shells, it's also combined with other different substances. So the calcium carbonate from a theropod might be different to one from a coral or a foraminifer. And even though all these calcium carbonates get dissolved at acidic pH, the threshold for the dissolution, they might change slightly. And that's one of the reasons why we cannot just study one species. We have to study many different, and some of them might be affected at a pH of, let's say, 7.8, and other ones at 7.9, and other ones at 7.5. Other might not be affected at all.
But they're right in the base of the food chain.
Yeah, that's the thing with some of these phytoplankton. This is the case for all of these things. Corals, if you affect corals, you affect corals, and then everything that lives in the corals. If you affect phytoplankton, you affect phytoplankton, but also invertebrates, fish. So the thing is, where does the chain reaction end? Okay, so the question is if there's any way we can neutralize the acidity in the ocean to save the corals or other organisms. And there were many initiatives trying to sink excess CO2 into the bottom of the ocean. And it was very popular for many years trying to see how to do that. And then people started to see, well, now what happens when we have all that CO2 down there? What happens with the organisms that live there? Or what happens if something goes wrong and suddenly, boom, you have all this CO2 in a localized part of the ocean? So I'm not an expert on the area, but to my understanding, most of those efforts, they lost a lot of momentum lately. I don't think they're very popular right now. And I don't know of any other way. The only reasonable way is to slow down burning of fossil fuels and find cleaner alternative sources of energy. The question is regarding the cell cultures that we kept them in the dish, and she's asking if we have if they divide and what is the rate of cell division. And so we haven't measured cell division per se. What seems to happen is some cell types seem to die off faster than others. We don't know exactly which ones. Other studies from 10 maybe years ago, they found that some of these cells do divide. And another interesting finding is by Paul Falkowski at Rutgers, one of our collaborators. He found that some of these cells, they might actually aggregate together and form a functional polyp that has four cell layers, and they calcify. But instead of calcifying in the bottom of the dish, they calcify on top. That is published in PLOS One, a scientific journal. And they're microscopic, but it's an excellent model to study calcification in vitro, and that's why we're collaborating with him. And we just done this once, and it's amazing. Just after 2 weeks, they call them nanopolyps, and we saw them. Like they seem to just congregate and be functional, with salt and telly or without them. And so, we'll see in the future. We hope to use those in the future and characterize them in more detail. So the question is, if we have developed sequencing studies to study this, especially epigenetics. So first, with sequencing study, he refers if we can quantify, for example, mRNA or proteins to see what proteins are expressed in the different cell types. We have not done that. We expect to do that in the future. And the epigenetics question is very, very good question, very specialized. But basically what it means is that sometimes you can just, let's say you have a coral exposed to ocean acidification or any other stress, some things might block certain parts of the DNA and prevent certain genes to be expressed or other genes to be expressed more. And you might be able to follow that in the next generation. That's called epigenetics. And to my knowledge, nobody has done that in corals yet. But it's something that we'd love to do in the future. But the thing with coral physiology is that it's like we are here, and what you're talking about is there. And I would love to do that, but first we have to do all of this. Yeah. So the question is, if working with certain rocks in the desert, supposedly some of them have CO, they were formed when CO2 in the atmosphere was 7,000 ppm. Well, I don't know if that, assuming that number is accurate, which seems a little bit high, but assuming it was much higher than now, the main problem we have with elevated CO2 in the atmosphere and in the ocean is not only that the magnitude of the increase, but also how fast it's happening. It's not the same to build up from here to here over 100 million a year, which gives time to organisms to adapt maybe and to the new conditions, than to doing the same thing over 100 years. So I don't know if assuming that number is accurate, it's a different scenario compared with ocean acidification, because presumably those levels were, it took a long time to build there, and then they remain stable for many hundreds of millions of years. I don't know if I'm answering your question. Basically, I don't know. So the question is, if there are any models or speculations on mechanisms that might allow organisms to adapt and cope? Good question. The thing is that until very recently, most of us, we thought that a few like 50, 60, 100 years is very short for evolution, and that might be still true, but there are other research that suggests that the genetic variability that already exists, it might be the hope. And just to give an example, there's a research at USC by Dr. Manahan on oysters. And what they found is that different strains of oysters have very complex genetics, but they were able to get pure lines with pure lines of oysters. And they found that this particular line, they use, let's say, 50% of their energy for basal metabolic rate, but this other one only uses, let's say, 25. What that means is that they're both oysters. They're both the same species of oysters. But what that means is that maybe these species of oysters, when you add ocean acidification, they only have 50% of their energy budget to compensate for that, and they might die. But this other one, they have 75% of the budget for other things, so they might use some extra to compensate for ocean acidification, and they might still have enough to reproduce and survive. That has been, to my knowledge, has only been shown in oysters so far, and that's unpublished data. But it might happen with other animals. Remember, corals, they spawn millions and millions of eggs and sperm, so there's definitely genetic variation there, and the hope that some of them are going to be selected and be stronger.
Well, thank you very much for a wonderful talk.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.